Om Agyanti Mandasya Gyananjana Sulakaya Chakshur Malitam Dinna Tasmai Shri Gave Namaha Nama Om Vishmada Kishavista Bhutale Shrimate Vaishnu Swaminiti Namane Tatali Bhagavata Tvam Dishana Vena Cha Prabhupata Sivasasyam Yami Namurasham Nama Om Vishmada Kishavista Bhutale Shrimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sasvati Deme Govani Pachane Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shivasari Go Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama So I feel like nearly apologizing that I'm again sitting here since I was only here for 2 days ago. So I hope you will not get too quickly sick and tired of me. So we'll read from Canto 10, chapter 59, verse number 4. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Gadaya Nirbibeda Dvin Shastra Durgani Svayaka Chakrena Agnim Jalam Vayu Purapasham Statasina Karaya Nirbi Pedradrin Shastadugani Swayaka Chakrena Genjalam Vayum Purapasham Statasina Gadaya, with his club, Nirbibeda, he broke through. Adrin, hills, Shastra Durgani, the weapon obstacles, Sayaka, with his arrows. Chakrena, with his disc. Agnim, the fire. Jalam, water. Vayum, and wind. Murapasam, the cable obstructions. Tata, similarly. Asina, with his sword. Translation. With his club, the Lord broke through the rock fortifications. With his arrows, the weapon fortifications. With his disc, the fire, water, and wind fortifications. And with his sword, the Murapasha cables. Responsively. With his club, the Lord broke. Through the rock fortifications. With his arrows, the weapon fortifications. With his disc, the fire, water, and wind fortifications. And with his sword, the Murapasha cables. So now we have about 17 verses without a purport describing the fight. So I will read them, but I thought because it is so many, we will not read the Sanskrit just to get through it a bit faster. So next verse. With the sound of his conch shell, Lord Gadadhar then shattered the magic seals of the fortress, along with the hearts of its brave defenders, and with his heavy club he demolished the surrounding earthen ramparts. Next verse. The five-headed demon Mura, who slept at the bottom of the city's moat. What's moat?
The ring of water around the castle.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Awoke and rose up out of the water when he heard the vibration of Lord Krishna's Panchajanya conchal, a sound as terrifying as the thunder at the end of the cosmic age. Next verse. Shining with the blinding terrible effulgence of the sun's fire at the end of a millennium, Mura seemed to be swallowing up the three worlds with his five mouths. He lifted up his trident and fell upon Garuda, the son of Taksha, like an attacking snake. Next verse. Mura wheeled his trident and then hurled it fiercely at Garuda, roaring from all five mouths. The sound filled the earth and sky, all directions and the limits of outer space, until it reverberated against the very shell of the universe. Wow. Then, with two arrows, Lord Hari struck the trident flying towards Garuda and broke it into three pieces. Next, the Lord hit Mura's faces with several arrows, and the demon angrily hurled his club at the Lord. As Mura's club sped towards him on the battlefield, Lord Gadagraj intercepted it with his own and broke it into thousands of pieces. Mura then raised his arms high and rushed at the unconquerable Lord, who easily sliced off his heads with his disc weapon. Lifeless, Mura's decapitated body fell into the water like a mountain whose peak has been severed by the power of Lord Indra's thunderbolt. The demon's seven sons, enraged by their father's death, prepared to retaliate. Ordered by Bhumasura, Mura's seven sons, Tamra, Antariksha, Shravana, Vibhavasu, Vasu, Nabasvan, and Aruna, followed their general, Pita, onto the battlefield, bearing their weapons. These fierce warriors furiously attacked invincible Lord Krishna with arrows, swords, clubs, spears, lances, and tridents, but the Supreme Lord, with unfailing prowess, cut this mountain of weapons into tiny pieces with his arrows. Sounds like a pretty fierce battle going on there. The Lord severed the heads, thighs, arms, legs, and armor of these opponents led by Pita and sent them all to the abode of Yamaraj. Narakasura, the son of the earth, could not contain his fury when he saw the fate of his military leaders. Thus he went out of the citadel with elephants born from the milk ocean, who were exuding mudder from their foreheads out of excitement. Lord Krishna and his wife, mounted upon Garuda, looked like a cloud with lightning sitting above the sun. Seeing the Lord, Bhoma released his Shatagni weapon at him, whereupon all of Bhoma's soldiers simultaneously attacked with their weapons. At that moment, Lord Gadagraj shot his sharp arrows at Bhumasura's army. These arrows, displaying variegated feathers, soon reduced that army to a mass of bodies with severed arms, thighs, and necks. The Lord similarly killed the opposing horses and elephants. Lord Hari then struck down all the missiles and weapons the enemy soldiers threw at him, O hero of the Kurus, destroying each and every one with three sharp arrows. Meanwhile, Garuda, as he carried the Lord, struck the enemy's elephants with his wings. Beaten by Garuda's wings, beak, and talons, The elephants fled back into the city, leaving Narakasura alone on the battlefield to oppose Krishna. Seeing that his army driven back and tormented by Garuda, Bhauma attacked with his spear, and which had once defeated Lord Indra's thunderbolt. But though struck by that mighty weapon, Garuda was not shaken. Indeed, he was like an elephant hit with a flower gown. Bhauma, frustrated in all his attempts, took up his trident to kill Lord Krishna. But even before he could release it, the Lord cut off his head with his razor-sharp chakra, as the demon sat atop his elephant. So there we have a little purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, as Bhauma raised his invincible trident, Satyabhama, sitting on Garuda with the Lord, said to Krishna, "Kill him right away." Mm-hmm. And Krishna did just that. So, as we know, Krishna sometimes does enjoy to have a good fight. And it looks like here he certainly had one. And not only that, but he also took Satyabhama along in order to give her a little adventure, how it said in the purport we read yesterday. I'll quickly have a look again. Where was it? Yeah, no, here it says, the Lord wanted to give his adventurous wife a novel experience,
yeah.
And thus took her to the scene of this extraordinary battle. So he certainly, you know, gave his adventurous wife a very novel experience. So on one hand we can say it's quite surprising that Satyabhama, she keeps quiet the whole time, you know. We don't really hear anything from her side, you know. And even in the last verse, we actually, you know, from the Bhagavatam, we don't get directly that information that she said to Krishna, "So now just kill him," you know. But it is Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti's comment in the purport that she actually said to him, "Kill him right away." And so Krishna just did that. And also, I think, yeah, also in that same purport from yesterday, it says that Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti notes that in the heat of battle, Queen Satyabhama would naturally become anxious for Lord Krishna's safety and pray for the battle to end. Thus, she would readily give permission to Krishna to kill the son of her expansion, Bhumi. So, you know, that's one little reason also why Krishna took her along, just to make her experience what's going on there so that she would give the permission. So, and we can say in one sense that is a little bit of a contrast to, for example, when Krishna is in seemingly in danger in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, the inhabitants, they're always very anxious about Krishna's safety. Actually also because there he is, the little cowherd boy. And also because the inhabitants in Vrindavan, they're completely covered over by Yogamaya. And they are not at all aware of the fact that Krishna is the supreme and invincible and he will be always victorious anyway. It doesn't matter what happens. So, but they are the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they are completely in anxiety, you know, about Krishna's safety, in that paternal mood or in the conjugal mood and so on. So in Vrindavan there is a little bit of a different mood there, that there is more that sweetness of that intimate relationship. So naturally, Krishna's devotees, they are experiencing a more intimate relationship when they are not at all aware of Krishna's power. That gives a more intimate and intense and sweet relationship. But Dwarka is a little bit of a different mood. And there obviously, you know, the queens are more in aware that he is the Supreme Personality, and there is more that mood of awe and reverence there. And actually the other day when I was reading the Bhagavatam, I found a nice little thing which describes the difference between Vaikuntha and Vrindavan. And although here we are not talking about Vaikuntha, but still I thought it fits quite nicely. It's just a nice, sweet little comment. It says, Srila Sanatana Goswami comments that because in Vrindavan Krishna goes barefoot and can thus directly mark the earth with the symbols of his lotus feet, that transcendental land is even more glorious than Vaikuntha, where Vishnu wears slippers. So, yesterday when I was reading, I was thinking, well, most likely in Dwarka, Krishna also wears slippers, you know. He doesn't go barefoot, we can assume. At least in the battle, you know. And so, that's why Vrindavan, there's a certain special sweetness there, because there he doesn't wear slippers and he goes barefoot and he marks with his lotus feet the transcendental land, you know, with his transcendental symbols of the lotus, his lotus feet. So in that way we can understand, you know, that in Krishna's relationships in Vrindavan there is some special sweetness there, which is only there, nowhere else to find. So also, you know, we can understand that certainly Krishna could have finished that battle much quicker. It wouldn't have to drag on so long with so many different exchanges there and you know, smashing each other's weapons and so on. So Krishna could have finished the whole battle within 2 seconds, you know, just decapitated Mura and Naraka, and that would have been it. But, and certainly he wouldn't even have to do it himself. Very easily you could just send somebody or make some arrangement that the whole job would have been done much quicker and without his involvement. So, but of course, you know, Krishna is doing that, and he likes to do that, to stretch things out a little bit, you know, in order to make his devotees and his associates more anxious. That's actually what he is achieving with that. And also in the following verses we can see, you know, that finally the demons are killed and the battle is over and the demigods are offering prayers, glorification, and they're showering flowers and gowns onto him and so on. So naturally that whole, you know, that whole relief, oh, finally he made it, he killed everybody. So that is much greater there when Krishna stretches things out a little bit. And we have this happening a lot, you know, that then the demigods, they all glorify Krishna after he kills the demons. And you know, and in one sense we can say even they are sometimes a little bit in anxiety. Will Krishna really make it? Will he be victorious? Or maybe not. So, in that way, actually Krishna is very, very expert in making his devotees more eager in order to enhance their eagerness, their anxiousness, their greed for him. So, and this greed is exactly what a person needs in order to actually go back to God. So Rupa Goswami is describing this very nicely in Punjabali, that he says, pure devotional service in Krishna consciousness cannot be had Even by pious activity in hundreds and thousands of lives, it can be attained only by paying one price, that is, intense greed to obtain it. If it is available somewhere, one must purchase it without delay. So this is actually the only price a living entity has to pay, that intense, complete intense greed to get Krishna. Nothing else is actually needed. No other qualification we need. We don't have to be very learned. We don't have to be a pundit and know so many verses. We don't have to be wealthy. We don't have to be beautiful. Nothing of all that is needed. The only qualification we do need is that very intense greed, that complete anxiousness of somehow or other getting Krishna. So, and also Gaur Govinda Maharaj, he's describing this very nicely in his different books, mainly Guru Vandanam and Puri Prashna, that he always emphasizes this need of crying out to Krishna, to be in complete desperation, wanting Krishna by all means, and actually crying out for him. And Prabhupada also describes that, you know, the mood of chanting, that we should chant in that mood of a child crying out in desperation for his mother. And Gaur Govinda Maharaj makes that comment. He says actually an ISKCON temple is like a crying school where we learn how to cry out to Krishna. So, you know, here in Melbourne we also have a very nice crying school. So now we just have to learn that art, you know, of crying out to Krishna. So that is a nice meditation actually, which we can have when we chant our rounds, that we really try and develop this anxiousness and this desperation to cry out for him. And naturally that to develop that, to cultivate that crying out mood is of course much easier when we have some little distress. So that's why actually a distressful situation is really Krishna's mercy, because then it's much easier to develop this desperation. So that's why we also find that in countries where life is pretty comfortable and so on, there it is much harder to really develop that desperation to get out of here, you know. Like Australia, everything is quite comfortable, and certainly the level of sense enjoyment is much higher than in most parts of the world. You might forget that if you don't travel so much, you know. You might think everywhere in the world people live like in Australia, but I mean most of the time I do spend, you know, in countries where people are very poor. And, you know, and really if we look on the world map, we can clearly see that those countries like Australia where people live in so much comfort and they are a minority, you know, definitely, you know. So, but in any case, even if we might be living in a pretty comfortable situation, but Krishna is very expert to actually create some situations just in order to help us to cry out. That's the only reason why sometimes we have to face some difficulties. And also in the Bhagavatam there's a few nice parts where Krishna is also demonstrating that how he is helping his devotees in order to become more anxious. For example, in the rasa dance, when Krishna all of a sudden disappears and the gopis become very anxious. Where has he gone? And there's a very nice purport where this is also further explained, how Krishna is increasing the affection of his devotees through separation, through, you know, withdrawing all of a sudden. And it says there, that's 10th canto, 32 chapter. But the reason, yeah, that's a verse, Krishna is saying, but the reason why I do not immediately reciprocate with the affection of living beings, even when they worship me, O gopis, is that I want to intensify their loving devotion. They then become like a poor man who has gained some wealth and then lost it, and who thus becomes so anxious about it that he cannot think of anything else. And in the purport it is more explained. Yet, even if the Lord is approached by someone with devotion to intensify the devotee's love, the Lord may not immediately reciprocate fully. In fact, the Lord is truly reciprocating. After all, a sincere devotee always prays to the Lord, please help me to love you purely. Therefore, the Lord's so-called neglect is actually the fulfillment of the devotee's prayer. Lord Krishna intensifies our love for him by apparently separating himself from us. And the result is that we achieve what we really wanted and prayed for, intense love of the Absolute Truth, Krishna. Thus, Lord Krishna's apparent negligence is actually his thoughtful reciprocation and the fulfillment of our deepest and purest desire. Very nice. Also, there is another little similar section, and a little bit different, but still it makes the same point. That's in the story where Krishna lifts Govardhan Hill. And there also Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he often makes very nice, you know, deep comments about different aspects. So there also Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that the severe distress Indra apparently inflicted upon the residents of Vrindavan was an arrangement made by Sri Krishna's pastime potency to enhance the loving dealings between the residents and the Lord. So meaning, you know, the suffering Indra inflicted by sending all the rain, you know. So this was actually an arrangement by Krishna's pastime potency in order to enhance the loving relationship between the residents and the Lord. The Acharya gives the analogy that for a hungry person, the pain of hunger increases the happiness he feels when he finally eats excellent food. And thus, hunger can be said to enhance the pleasure of eating. Similarly, the residents of Vrindavan, although not experiencing ordinary material anxiety, felt a type of distress at the activities of Indra, and thus intensified their meditation on Krishna. When the Lord finally acted, the result was wonderful. Yeah. So very nicely described how hunger increases the pleasure of eating. And this is also very nicely described in that pastime with lifting Govardhan Hill, how afterwards, like when Krishna lifts the hill, it's not like the residents just simply waiting there, you know, like we would be waiting, standing under an umbrella, so when is this rain finally stopping or something. But no, there's all these very sweet, you know, exchanges between the devotees and the Lord happening, you know, according to their relationship with the Lord. They are having all very charming and sweet pastimes while they're standing there under Govardhan Hill. Like, for example, that the gopas, that the senior, you know, cowherd men, they feel, oh, Krishna, he's such a little boy, maybe he will get tired, you know, so let us help him. And they put up their sticks, you know, sometimes in pictures we can see that how they help to hold up Govardhan Hill with their sticks, you know. And then the gopis, they get all in anxiety that maybe he would be hungry. and you know, and he hasn't even got the chance to eat because he has to work so hard lifting up the hill, you know. And then there's even little things there that, you know, already Krishna makes his jewelry become a little loose, you know, so it looks like he's actually losing weight. His belt is becoming a little loose, and the ankle belts are sliding a little down, you know, and they're all in anxiety. Oh my God, he's losing weight, you know, look at the jewelry, it's already nearly falling off, you know. So like that, there's all kinds of, you know, sweet dealings going on, you know. And that is certainly enhanced through that misery of that rain before, you know. So in that way we can clearly understand, yes, you know, Krishna increases like that the loving devotion and the intensity and the eagerness and so on through these different little pastimes. So yeah, so in that way we can clearly understand, you know, if Krishna actually gives us some distressing situation, that is there in order to increase our hankering for him. And you know, sometimes we can say we actually have a pretty shallow understanding of Krishna's mercy. You know, what is Krishna's mercy? The way we use it is quite a shallow understanding, that usually we say, yes, you know, if Krishna fulfills our desires, then we say, oh yes, Krishna's mercy, you know, it happened like this, you know. And we think, yes, this is Krishna's mercy when everything goes the way we want it and he fulfills all those little, you know, desires we are having in our heart. Yes, it is Krishna's mercy, you know. But then if something doesn't happen the way we expect it, then we think, oh, you know, why is Krishna doing that? He's not giving us his mercy, you know, for some reason. You know, what did we do wrong that he's not giving us his mercy? But this is a very shallow understanding, actually, you know. This is that understanding that, you know, whatever we desire should be happening and Krishna should be our order supplier arranging what we think is good, and Krishna should sanction our plans. We make so many plans in our life and we think if Krishna gives that sanction, then it is his mercy. And if he doesn't, it's not. And sometimes we can even lose faith, you know. Young devotee might think, oh, you know, something happened, my husband died or whatever. Why is Krishna doing this? Obviously he doesn't exist. Can't he see how much I'm chanting? You know, why is he arranging such a thing? You know, and a person might even lose his faith and think, well, Krishna obviously doesn't exist. You know, like there's this famous story Prabhupada often says, that, you know, that in the war, you know, when the wife's praying, oh please God, let my husband return from the war, and then they don't return from the war, and then they say, well, obviously he doesn't exist. You know, why didn't he hear my prayers? I was praying so intensely, you know. So, but as a devotee we know this, or we should know, that this is actually a very shallow understanding of Krishna's mercy. So and here we hear, you know, what is actually Krishna's mercy, you know, to increase our eagerness, our hankering for him, to arrange some obstacle, some difficulty, some separation like that, you know. That is actually Krishna's mercy, because if we see it in the Krishna conscious way, then it will increase our hankering. So and in this regard, I remember I had some, you know, some practical experience in that way. Like about two or three years ago in Russia, every year in Russia there's a very big festival, Dubnomorsk festival or Napa festival. Many Maharajas go there and give wonderful lectures for 1 week. So, and after this festival, there was a car going back with devotees to Latvia to to Riga, and I'm kind of passing through there very often, so I know the devotees there. So in this car, on the way back from this festival, they had an accident. And it was actually not even such a bad accident, but somehow the main problem was that two Matajis, they were lying in the back sleeping, and the driver was driving the whole night through. So he kind of was just a little absent-minded, and he drove on the back of a truck. But because two Matajis, they were lying in the back sleeping with their head in driver's direction. Yeah, there were one Mataji died on the spot, left her body, because just through that bump of the head against, you know, the partition there between the back and the front, she just smashed some inner arterioles and left her body on the spot. And the other Mataji, she broke her neck. Yeah, she broke her neck. And she was in danger for quite a while. And it was in Russia, in some village there. She ended up in some village hospital there and was lying there for a whole week. Nothing happened. And so on. And then finally she was transported to Riga and so on. But anyway, to cut the whole long story short, she remained paralyzed. You know, she had some operations, and she's a quadriplegic. She can hardly even move her hands. Very little function she has in the hands, but legs, nothing, you know. Whole body, you know, even urine, stool, nothing under control, you know, completely paralyzed, you know. So this was, of course, a really, you know, big shock to everybody, and of course, especially to herself, you know. She was a young girl, 23 years old, beautiful body, intelligent. She had so many big plans for her life. Coming back from this festival, and then wow, you know, all of a sudden your whole life completely changes, you know, and all your plans are completely smashed to pieces, you know. So not easy to see such a situation as Krishna's mercy, you know, not easy, you know, very difficult. So and then one day, you know, I was just there passing through when this all happened, so I went to the hospital to visit her. And you know, many devotees, they were trying to encourage her in such a way that they were saying, oh, you know, I'll pray for Krishna, to Krishna, that you will walk again, you will walk, you will walk, you know. They were telling her, you will walk, you know. And but I somehow couldn't go along with this, you know, also because I am a physiotherapist by profession, and I know, you know, it is not so inevitable that she will walk again, you know. And I just didn't want to give her these false hopes, you know. So I simply said to her, actually, you know, I don't even pray to Krishna whether you will walk or not walk, you know. What's the big deal about walking? There's millions of people who walk, you know. So just to come back to that stage where you can actually walk, this is not really the goal, you know, of this situation. So many people walk, you know. But I said to her, well, actually what I'm praying for is to Krishna that you will become a very outstanding devotee through this whole situation, you know. And then she appreciated that, and she was just looking at me and she was saying, yes, I really want to serve Krishna, but now I can't. And the way she said that, it actually, it was quite amazing. It really gave me this realization, yes. She has this greed, you know. I really want to serve Krishna. She has it through this experience, you know. But we don't have it, even though we have a healthy body and we could be doing so much service. But we, unfortunately, we don't have that same greed that she has. And I really, it just really hit me that I was thinking, yes, this is why that situation is actually Krishna's mercy. Because through this situation, she came to this point of developing this greed. And this is exactly the qualification to go back to Godhead. This is what we need, to go back to Godhead. And she was so fortunate that she had it. And we are actually the unfortunate ones who have a healthy body, But, you know, we find so many excuses why we can't serve, why we don't want to serve, and so on, you know. So it was quite a strong realization that I was thinking, yes, she is actually the lucky one, you know, because that whole situation brought her to that point where she was so eager, you know. And surely enough, also, you know, we can certainly say through that accident she actually became such a more serious devotee. Like before that all happened, she actually was not so serious, you know. She thought, oh, Krishna consciousness. She liked to play Madanga. So she thought, oh, Krishna consciousness is just fun playing Madanga and that's it, you know. And she had so many other plans for her life and this and that and so on, you know. But this whole accident really made her very serious, you know. And then later on, you know, she recovered from the initial dangerous, you know, situation, acute situation, and she was in a wheelchair and she stayed in the ashram for a while just to help her to, you know, get more into Krishna consciousness, and so she would have association and so on. And it was quite amazing, you know, even though she had so little function in her hands, but she was just so determined to do some little service, you know. And she was making the gowns for the Gaunitai deities, you know, they're not so big, 48 centimeters. So, and it took her hours, you know, literally hours to make this garland, you know, because she had very little function in her hands, you know, and she was just sitting there for hours making this garland, you know. And somebody else could have done it so much quicker, you know, but she was just so determined. And she was always preaching to the girls, you know. You know, she was always preaching to them, saying, you know, you better serve, you know, you've got a body who is healthy, you can do it, I can't. You know, so she was always preaching to them, you know, really, really, you know, with quite a bit of realization, you know. You know, so, so in that way, you know, certainly Krishna sometimes arranges pretty amazing things, and it's not so easy to understand his plans, you know, and to accept them as Krishna's mercy. But then if we are a little sincere and if we look a little deeper, we can actually detect it, you know. And if we can then actually wholeheartedly accept it as Krishna's mercy and use it as a situation in order to increase our eagerness and our hankering, then we fully take advantage of Krishna's blessing, you know, and we can actually perceive it, and we can actually be grateful. We can actually be grateful for it, you know. Also, you know, just to finish the story with that Mataji, she's still sitting in the wheelchair, but actually, you know, we can really say this whole accident really was a blessing in many ways, because also one nice devotee, he actually married her. Yeah, he is Mahateja Prabhu. He's disciple of Bhakti Vaibhava Swami. He's very much into Ayurveda, and you know, he's giving different courses and seminars. And he was one of our first brahmacharis there when my former husband and I were preaching there and establishing the temple. And yeah, he married her. He was, you know, he kind of took it as his mission to try and get her on her feet again, you know. And he was taking care of her, and then they developed a relationship, and he married her, and he looks really nicely after her. So, and I'm pretty sure he would have never married her if that hadn't happened, you know. Because, as I said, she actually was not such a sincere devotee, you know. But Mahateja Prabhu, he is a very nice devotee, you know. So, and in that way, you know, her spiritual life actually was increased and enhanced through that whole thing, you know. And she spends quite some time in Mayapur and goes to South India and does some treatments there and so on, you know. So she actually didn't lose, you know, ultimately. It was really Krishna's blessing, that whole thing, you know. Yeah, so in that way, Krishna has all kinds of, you know, wonderful ways. Wonderful in the literary sense. How he increases the eagerness and the greed of his devotees. So we just have to learn to see them and accept them as Krishna's mercy. Alright, so I'll finish there. Maybe somebody has some comment, some question.
I have a comment about in Vrindavan, when Krishna jumped into the lake to kill Kaliya, the mother Yashoda was in great anxiety.
Yeah.
She almost wanted to finish her life. How my young boy is going to kill the snake?
Yeah.
And second instance was when Krishna was holding the Govardhan Hill. And it is shaking, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Krishna drops the hill a few centimeters, you imagine, to get everybody in anxiety.
Such a message. You
take
2 hours in car to go around it.
Yeah, it's very, that pastime is very nicely described in this one book, you know, with Krishna's pastimes. What's it called? Vrindavan Das.
And my friend is very correctly, that hill, that river hill was much bigger 5,000 years back. Now it's much smaller.
So it would have been much more heavy then. Yeah, or in that description, there's so many wonderful little details there, you know, about the whole Leela, you know. So it's very nice. Also, at the very end, you know, there's that section when everybody goes home back to Vrindavan, you know, and the gopis, they're very, very happily, they're glorifying Krishna, you know. And there's one purport where Prabhupada says, it's very natural that any young man wants to do something amazing in front of young girls. And it also says in one purport there that now finally the gopis they are allowed, you know, to glorify Krishna publicly, because usually they're a little shy and because it's kind of a little against the etiquette in some way, you know, for them to glorify him too much, you know. But because he performed that wonderful pastime, so that gives them permission. To glorify Krishna very publicly and from their full heart, you know. They don't have to hold back for change, you know. They can utter all the feelings and glorifications they have, you know. But in many other incidences, they kind of keep that very secret and intimate, you know. They're not voicing that so much, you know. Yeah, there's so many sweet details. Yeah. Also, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he gives a lot of amazing angles to different pastimes. Like this year when I was in Mayapur, Banuswami was giving a very nice class. And he is very expert in all these little intricacies and details, so he's always digging up all kinds of amazing, you know, commentaries from different acharyas. So he was saying, you know, that we might be wondering why Krishna, he was promising to the gopis to return to Vrindavan, but then from Krishna book, it looks like he never did, you know, and how come that he's breaking his promise? So and then Banuswami was saying that there's some comments of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where he says that when Uddhava went to Vrindavan to understand the love of the gopis, that he could actually see two sets of gopis and two sets of Nanda Maharajas and Yashodas, and one set was completely happy, joyful and bliss, relaxed, and the other set was in complete lamentation and devastation and completely grey and pale and oh, their hearts were burning out of separation from Krishna. So then the conclusion is that actually Krishna did go back. And there's a double set of Krishna there, one that remained in Dwarka and one that actually went back. You know? But only one set of gopis and associates, they see that Krishna coming back. And they, you know, are in complete ecstasy and they're relishing all different pastimes there. And then the other set is in complete devastation and separation and agony. But from Krishna book we actually don't get that information, you know. But then Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti Thakur, he puts all these amazing perspectives there, you know, which make things even more relishable and more sweet, you know.
Hunger is the best spice in
food. Spice. Oh, spice. Yeah. Yeah, so that confirms that purport. Yeah. Yeah, or we have that saying, hunger is the best cook. But then we also have the saying, you shouldn't go shopping when you're hungry. Otherwise you, you know, load up your trolley too much, you know. Yeah, so hunger is doing all kinds of things, obviously. Okay, anything else? Okay, so we'll finish there then. Thank you very much. Vandachamad Bhagavatam Ki, Shri Prabhupada Ki, Samamita Bhaktivinoda Ki.